making TV special.
Dennis. Made with creamy butter.
And you know what that means.
It's happening. I can feel it.
Yep.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another special interview episode from MediaMonarchy.com. My name is James Evan Pilato. I'm your host and webmaster of the site and show, and it's October 28th, 2009, and on the line again is our good friend Albert Lanier. Thanks for taking the time, man.
Thank you, James, and thank everyone out there who's listening to this interview on Media Monarchy.
I really
appreciate
it. It's
nice to be back here.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Absolutely. So we talked back in August for folks, and again, all these things and all the things we're going to discuss are going to be, you know, linked up in the show notes, and you can pursue things on your own. But something we definitely want to get right into is that you're fresh back from the Hawaii International Film Festival. Now, you're based in Hawaii, so can you give us kind of a rundown quickly on that?
Yeah, I was covering the Hawaii International Film Festival. For those individuals who aren't aware of yours truly, and there are probably millions who aren't, and I don't blame you, I am a freelance writer and journalist, and I also have been an online film critic and reviewer since 2002 for a site called AintItCoolNews.com. And basically, I cover film festivals here in Hawaii. I'm kind of the Hawaii correspondent for Hawaii, for Ain't It Cool. And this year was no different. I covered HIFF, as it's known, the Hawaii National Film Festival, and saw a number of films. I can't go into every title. And I don't know what kind of film lovers or film fans are out there. The opening night film was a film from the director of a film called The Host, Bong Joon-ho.
Oh, okay. I'm familiar with The Host. That was kind of...
Yes, The Host, of course, is a quote-unquote monster film, but it's so much more. I saw this film a few years ago in a review for Ain't It Cool, and it's a fantastic film. And he did an interesting film called Mother, kind of a more crime-oriented film. Very interesting drama, I would say. The closing night film was a film called The Warrior and the Wolf by... I'm trying to make sure I have his name correct. Tian Zhuang Zhong. I hope I correctly stated that. The director, fifth generation of the Beijing Film Academy. People know directors have come out of there like Zhang Yimou and various others. And he's known for his film, The Horse Thief. I saw a film he did a couple of years ago called Go Master, which I liked very much. And so he did The Warrior and the Wolf, which is sort of set a period in Chinese history where you have imperial forces that are fighting nomadic tribes. So, interesting. And the centerpiece gala was from a name that's familiar with a lot of people, John Woo. If you've seen films like Bullet in the Head, The Killer... even his American films, Mission Impossible 2, Face Off, and so forth, you know who John Woo is. And he did a epic film in China, probably one of the biggest budgets in Chinese history, a film called Red Cliff, which is based basically dealing with the Battle of the Red Cliffs, where you have imperial forces led by a prime minister called Cao Cao who are facing two warlords. What Cao Cao has done is he managed to dispatch a lot of these other warlords in terms of China, and he wants more bloodshed, apparently. He wants to go after these two kingdoms, Wu and Zhu. And so the film basically deals with this Battle of Red Cliffs. Red Cliffs was actually done in two parts. I think the total was about over 4 hours. The film that I saw here in Hawaii was about 2 hours, about 150 minutes or so, close to that. That's the Western version, that's the American version, or the version that you'll be shown in the West. The Asian version was shown, I think, last year, and it's done very well. This film, I think, had about an $80 million budget. It's made over $200 million thus far in Asia, so it's a pretty big hit. And it's quite a sprawling war epic, lots of CGI. For those people who are big John Woo fans and also big war epic fans or into war films, this is a must-see film. Definitely. Red Cliffs. And, of course, I've reviewed that for Ain't It Cool News.
Now, when I was checking out your big rundown on a lot of the films. I was, even as a film fan myself, I was surprised at just the large amount of names that I wasn't familiar with. One of the ones that I am familiar with, and we'll touch on this quickly, is the new Terry Gilliam film.
Right. The Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus, which is Heath Ledger's last film. It's his last performance. And I have to say, he's terrific in it. He's terrific. And the scenes that he was able to film before his death. It's an interesting film. I like Gilliam's film. Well, I'm a Monty Python fan myself. And I like Gilliam's films because I think they're about, as I mentioned in my review, they're about the bifurcation between sort of the world of imagination and sort of the world of reason, of the non-imaginative world, to put it lightly. And I think with the Imaginarium, of course, we have the imagination, we have these sort of overwhelming visuals in this film. And it's a good film. There's some good performances in it. Christopher Plummer plays the good doctor himself. And as I mentioned in my review of the film, there's a scene I really loved in it, where there's a character called Mr. Nick, and Mr. Nick meets Dr. Parnassus, who's in this sort of Tibetan Buddhist enormous shrine, and he wonders, well, what's going on here? And he says, well, we tell the same story over and over again because it's a story that sustains the universe. And I love that line, sustains the universe. And so that was my favorite scene in the movie, but it's a good film. I think if you're a Heath Ledger fan, it's definitely worth watching. I don't know if a Gilliam film will be your taste, but it's definitely worth watching overall. Of course, his role was completed in the sense of the Imaginarium is sort of like this. The Imaginarium, if you could say it, there's a kind of stage. I don't know if you're familiar with theater too much, but I've called it kind of like Commedia dell'arte. Commedia dell'arte, one of these traveling theaters, and there's like a sort of mirror, and you go through this mirror, and you're in the quote Imaginarium. Of course, it's powered by the doctor's own imagination himself. But for the sequences where they're in this sort of world of imagination, you have Johnny Depp, and you have Jude Law, and you have Colin Farrell. Colin Farrell especially has some really good scenes in this film. I think he really chews some scenery up in this film. but it's a film, I think if you're a Terry Gilliam fan, this is a must-see. It's a good film. It's not a great film. I think he's done better films. One of my personal favorites in the Gilliam canon is The Adventures of Baron Munchausen. Terrific film. And another is Brazil, which I think is a, if not masterpiece, then a near masterpiece. That's a simply great film. Mm-hmm. And it's an interesting film when we talk about secret societies and conspiracies, or at least in a certain industrials. Actually, it's interesting when you talk about police state, because it's, in essence, it's almost like a police state in that film. You know, you have a freedom fighter, your resistance fighter, played by Robert De Niro in that film, who's Harry Tuttle. You know, and I think the main character is like the bureaucrat or something, some kind of minor bureaucrat. Uh-huh. So you have a kind of Orwellian 1984-ish type world in Brazil. So, I think those films are better. But The Imaginarium Dr. Parnassus is a good film. And it was enjoyable to watch with a packed screening. I mean, you know, it was one of those screenings where I was fortunate that I could get, you know, my hands on the arm post. So many people.
Well, and I imagine that film's going to be pretty highly anticipated in the
season. Yeah, I think that film will probably be one of the most anticipated releases of the fall.
When you put Terry Gilliam together with the late Heath Ledger and then folks like Johnny Depp and all that, yeah, that's probably going to be huge. So,
from what I heard, the final note, I heard Heath Ledger improvised a lot of his performance, and I think Gilliam was saying, well, this guy's terrific. And he's terrific in the film.
Huh.
But that's the end of that.
Well, then we've pretty well set the table, I think, for what our main topic of discussion is going to be today, and that is essentially that the secret is out.
Correct.
So why don't you tell folks, break this down a little bit before we really go into it.
Right. Basically, what we'll be discussing are secret societies and conspiracies in film and television. And the reason why I'm going to be discussing this is because of some of the currents, some of the things that have come out recently, some of the currents in the media. For example, you have Dan Brown's new book, The Lost Symbol, which has come out. The Lost Symbol, of course, is about Freemasonry. And, of course, Freemasonry, as we all know, secret society. Though some people may argue about Freemasonry, it's one of those controversial orders and organizations that's always had controversy. It's always going to be debated. But that's a current because it's a conspiratorial current. And if you look at the work of Dan Brown, of course, his books have been adapted to movies, right? We know The Da Vinci Code came out a couple of years ago with Tom Hanks. Interestingly enough, while doing some research, Tom Cruise is in a movie that's often cited as one of the better conspiracy movies. Well, that is Minority Report, directed by Steven Spielberg. Interestingly enough, who else is in that movie? Colin Farrell, who is in Imaginarium Dr. Parnassus, Six Degrees of Separation, I don't know. But we have The Da Vinci Code, which is an adaptation of the book by Dan Brown that was with Tom Hanks. Also, Tom Hanks was in, I believe it was this year's adaptation of Angels and Demons. Now, The Da Vinci Code, of course, deals with Opus Dei and the Priory of Zion. Angels and Demons deals with the Illuminati. Really, in the film, I hate to get away for you folks, the Illuminati is more of a red herring. So, I don't want to go too far into that. But so, we can see some of the currents in regards to conspiracy. Also, the former governor of Minnesota, Jesse Ventura, I'm sure everyone's familiar with him, he's doing a conspiracy show for True TV. So, we can see that conspiracy lore, as I call it, has a place in the media. And it's important to understand sort of a digression of this. I can't go into an exact, we're not going to go into a lengthy history here because we have a lot to cover. But when we take a look, my belief is that there is or there has become a, what I call a conspiratorial infrastructure in the major media, film and TV, but also with the internet. And that has kind of developed, not only in regards to films themselves and TV shows, but also sites, right? It's very clear on the internet, and it has kind of developed in film and TV. We're going to focus on that in this, of course, special edition of Media Market.
Well, I think what I thought you were going to say when you mentioned Tom Cruise a moment ago, that you were going to mention The Firm.
Interesting.
And that's
interesting.
A film that I haven't seen in a long, long time. But as I was, you know, kind of prepping myself for this talk, I was, wait, wasn't that kind of a conspiracy, a kind of a secret society?
Right. That's one way to put it. And that brings up an interesting point. Now, when we talk about conspiracy, what do we mean? I was on the web today, and just to make it simple for everyone and to get a source that people are familiar with, I decided to take a definition. I hadn't looked up this definition before online, but definitions of conspiracy is found on Wikipedia. Now, people have problems with Wikipedia. They say it's accurate, they say it's not accurate enough, what have you. But for purposes of our discussion, so that we have an agreed upon sort of digital space in which we can habit or go to for reference, I decided to get a definition from Wikipedia. And it talks about conspiracies. Right? Types of conspiracy. And it mentions about four. One is a cabal, which is an association between religious, political, or tribal officials to further their own ends, by intrigue usually. You have civil conspiracies, which involves agreements or confabulations between, meetings between people to deceive, mislead, or defraud others of legal rights. You have conspiracy in the criminal aspect, which is between persons to break a law or laws, right? So if I get together with five other people, in the law, it's very clear. In laws, it's very clear. Two or more people get together and meet and plan with the express purpose of committing an act.
And that's generally what you see folks being charged as in a lot of cases. You see, you know, and two counts of conspiracy.
Precisely. And, of course, political conspiracy is a plot to overthrow the government. So I thought I'd bring those references out and those definitions out so that people have a sense. When we talk about conspiracy here, we're going to primarily deal with conspiracies in, I would say, probably more of the political realm, because that's what most sites like Media Monarchy and most talk show hosts, whether it's an Alex Jones or someone else, they deal with conspiracies mostly in the political context. And when we deal with that in, and that's the primary vehicle when we talk about films and TV. It's the political aspect, or even the civil aspect, because I think they can often go together. And let's add to that the cabal, because that's very important. And you can have a cabal in a film that isn't necessarily political or religious. It may be criminal. So I think it's important to kind of deal with the kind of definition first before we get into the substance of our discussion. So when we discuss conspiracies, and I think another aspect would be secret societies, and my definition of secret societies would be any society that keeps its any organizational order that keeps its membership and or activities out of the public realm. In other words, it keeps them secret. So that's an important definition for us to consider.
Well, and I think the funny thing that the Masons will say to this day is we're not a secret society. We're a society with secrets.
Well, what's the difference?
Nothing at all.
Right. A secret society emphasizes the secret. A society of secrets emphasizes the society. Right.
And that's and then I guess that kind of helps explain it, because they always just kind of say that, no, you know, we do good things for the community. So it's a PR
move. I'm sure they do.
And they do.
Yeah. I mean, that's why I mentioned the Freemasons are inherently controversial. Anytime you read about Freemasonry, I've read about it over the years, and I have to admit that I've really done research into secret societies and conspiracies for over a decade now. Admittedly, this is not my professional interest. I'm a writer and journalist by profession, and I've never written about any of this professionally. Never. But I had a personal interest, partly because people encouraged me to look into it. I had people who encouraged me to look into the Federal Reserve. That's how I found out about the Federal Reserve. And so when I talk about, you know, secret societies and conspiracies in film and TV, we have to look at some of the sort of, it's kind of like an iceberg, right? We see X amount of the iceberg on top, while the great majority of it is cloaked by the sea, by the volume of water, right? That's usually what happens with icebergs. So what we want to be able to do is to deal, hopefully, not only with what we can see that's been put out there in the media. Take, for example, Richard Belzer, who's a comedian, or was a comedian, an actor known for shows like Homicide, and also for shows like Law & Order, SVU. He was on, I think it was Bill Marshall, Real Time, and he talked about the Federal Reserve.
I played that clip, actually, on my show a few weeks ago.
Absolutely. I believe I saw it there. Yeah, I believe I saw it there. And Belzer is no stranger to this. I mean, he's been interested in conspiracies. He wrote a book on conspiracies. In fact,
what's the name of it?
I happen to have it here. It's called UFOs, JFK, and Elvis. Conspiracies You Don't Have to Be Crazy to Believe, which came out, let me see, in 1999, about 10 years ago.
Well, there you go. So pre-9/11. And I find it interesting,
absolutely,
if I can throw out real quick, that you say you have a lot of friends sort of insisting that you look into things. I find that a very positive thing, because that's probably what I feel like I try and do in my own little way, is get people to try and look into things. So I think that's a positive thing.
Well, this was years ago. There were people, I don't know if they were friends, they were more acquaintances. Some of them I only talked to over the phone. I mean, some of them I didn't meet. Talked to over the phone. But they kind of encouraged me to look into the Federal Reserve. I knew nothing about the Federal Reserve. I knew nothing about Bilderberg. I knew nothing about Trilateral. I knew nothing about Council for Foreign Relations. I knew nothing about these organizations. I did research into it primarily because I was hearing about from other people. And you got to understand, this was like over 10 years ago, before we had Media Monarchy, before we had other sites. You didn't have the kinds of sites that were looking into these issues. Or they were probably around, but not too many of them.
No,
I mean, I looked
point,
up a lot of this stuff by reading books, I mean,
absolutely,
and other kinds of research.
Because at that
not
point,
by the internet.
A lot of the free, you know, blog services and websites and things that we have now, which is essentially what I use, yeah, none of that stuff was available then.
Right. So you're talking about trying to read really not always accessible books. Like, I read The Creature from Jekyll Island probably a few years ago. None Dare Call It Conspiracy, Gary Allen's book, which was a bestseller. And, of course, I kind of view myself as a individual who is a, I don't want to use the term scholar, but an amateur student of conspiracy lore. For me, it's not a matter of belief or disbelief. It's a matter of looking at conspiracies from an objective standpoint, which admittedly is what most people don't do. They dismiss them out of hand. I look at them objectively. And for me, it's not a matter of belief as it is a matter of, like, for example, the statement of conspiracy, you know, the term conspiracy theory is an inaccurate statement. Because theory is a pretty specific word, right?
Absolutely.
I mean, it's a scientific term. Because when you take, for example, evolution, it's called the theory of evolution. People assume that theories mean speculation or just opinion. No. Theories are a groundwork, a construct that is born from and it is provided by support. It has to be evidence to back up. In other words, whether, I don't know what people's beliefs are, and I don't really care, but whether you believe in evolution or not is irrelevant. It's a matter of what evidence is there to support the theory or to support the structure of it. You can't have a theory without evidence. So conspiracy theory implies that there is evidence behind these conspiracies. So when people say you believe in conspiracy theories, it immediately means that you have some kind of evidential framework. That you have some kind of framework of proof. You may not be able to prove it outright, but you have some aspect of evidence, something solid, something concrete to support it. Now again, my framework in regards to conspiracy is not to believe it, because that's not scientific. It's whether it's supportable or non-supportable. Whether it can be proven, whether it can't be proven. So I use the framework of proven conspiracies or disproven conspiracies, right? Most conspiracies are not disproven in the mainstream way. Take, for example, JFK, the JFK assassination. That is not a proven conspiracy, because mainstream bodies, like, with the exception of the House Select Committee on Assassinations in the 70s, but most official bodies support the Warren Commission. They don't go against it, right? I doubt Obama will say, well, the Warren Commission report is wrong. And obviously it was a conspiracy to kill Kennedy. No, it's unlikely they would say that, because that's not part of the official body of support. That's not the official stance. The official stance is the Warren Commission report settled the matter. Period. Now, of course, you also have the House Select Committee in the mid-70s saying there was probably a conspiracy. But that's one committee in an entire legislative body.
It is. I think, important to note that I believe the House Select Committee is the last official word on the assassination of JFK. So we at least have as the last official word that it was probably the result. And that's their quote. That's the operative word there, probably.
Because they held hearings and it was investigated by that body. So when they, and that was their conclusion, which is an interesting conclusion when you buttress that with the fact that there are numerous. Now, again, for me, it's a matter, speaking from an objective standpoint, It's a matter of, can you prove it or can you disprove it? That's the official way of looking. That's the way it should be looked at. Proof or lack of proof. For most people, it's a matter, really, it's disproven. They think, oh, conspiracies are foolish and stupid because they're disproven. Or they believe they're disproven. Right? As opposed to proven conspiracies. Proven conspiracies are Iran-Contra, Watergate. Those are proven conspiracies. And there are numerous other conspiracies. Mm-hmm. Right? So conspiracy has been used as a slur, as a kind of rhetorical battering ram, as a verbal sort of sword to strike down people.
It's used pejoratively. When people say it, it's used in a denigrating manner.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So now that we have that, we can get into the film and TV. So when we talk about conspiracies in films, where do we start? Why don't we, for lack of a better term, limit our discussion to the post-war era? Now, when we talk about conspiracies again, what I mention is this: primarily political, primarily somewhat civil, but primarily dealing with the cabal. And there are numerous films. And doing research for this discussion, I noticed a number of films that were listed on some of these sites, best conspiracy films. And there's some interesting, and I'll mention some of these briefly. And they're interesting to me. One film that came out is an interesting one called Blowout, which is directed by Brian De Palma in 1981. Mm-hmm. That film basically takes Chappaquiddick and mixes it with a kind of Michelangelo Antonioni-influenced story.
Oh,
basically,
wow.
What De Palma is doing...
The title is even a play on Antonioni's Blow Up, as opposed to this case of Blow Out with John Travolta.
And of course, Blow Up is also an interesting film. Came out in the late 60s. I was watching something on TCM about, I think it was thrillers, and they mentioned Blow Up because of the aspect of Blow Up, of course, is about a photographer between London and the 60s, and he happens to take a picture of a couple in a park, and he notices in one of the pictures on his contact sheet, he blows it up. There's something going on. He can see a body. So something's going on there. What Antonioni does in Blow Up, one could argue that Blow Up is a conspiracy film. But if it's a conspiracy film, it's a conspiracy film that's filtered through the matrix, through an art house matrix. So what Antonioni does in Blow Up is he doesn't create a thriller. He creates an art house film that intellectually examines this issue. A conspiratorial issue, but it examines it through a very contemplative, very intellectual framework.
I find
and
it
that's
to be
very different,
very rooted in that sort of swinging '60s era, and I think it can come off a little bit dated.
Yes, but it's a superb film.
Yes.
It's a first-rate film. Like, I saw it in college, and I saw it maybe a couple years ago, and it has a power that still remains because it combines to me the aspect of the slight conspiratorial aspect, which is there, which is what is behind the normal. When we look at conspiracies in films, it's a matter of what is behind the facade, what is behind the normal. I mentioned the iceberg, okay? We have the top of the iceberg. What's below the iceberg? That's the difference. See, the iceberg can hit you if you see it, but it's what's beneath the iceberg that really does damage, a la Titanic, right? Because they saw the iceberg, but it wasn't enough. It was beneath the iceberg that was so big that it had so much mass and volume that it ripped the ship apart, at least it ripped the hull apart. So it's beneath the iceberg that we need to deal with. And Blow Up is very good in that context. It's such a fascinating film. Yes, it's dated in regards to its time frame, when it was done. But the subject matter, the presentation of it, and I admit I'm an Antonioni fan, the whole aspect of art mixed with the sort of slightly political, conspiratorial aspect, and filtered through the art house sensibility is fascinating. And I think Blow Up is a great film.
But you wanted to talk about Blow Out.
Yes,
the Palm.
I mentioned Blow Out. I just wanted to briefly mention some of those films.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, you know, mentioning Blow Up kind of serves as a sort of metaphor for what we're talking about here. Just going through some of what I found on the internet, interesting conspiratorial films. Missing by Costa Gavras, that's basically alluding to Chile in the 70s. Mm-hmm. You know, 3 Days of the Condor, directed by Sidney Pollack. It's with Robert Redford. He's a CIA researcher in that film. You know, Alfred Hitchcock's Foreign Correspondent and Man Who Knew Too Much were good films. Interestingly enough, Hot Fuzz, which is kind of a satire of action films. That was listed in the conspiracy.
That's interesting. Yeah, I have seen that movie.
Another interesting one that's been noted in some of these lists or some of these websites is a film called The Truman Show with Jim Carrey.
Jim Carrey's
coming out now with Christmas Carol, but that's been seen as a conspiracy film. And
Truman Show essentially being a whole staged reality show for one man's life who doesn't know that he's the star of it.
Yeah, I saw it recently. I saw it again recently. It's a powerful film for me. I don't know why.
I think it's interesting, and it came out sort of at the right time in that.
It was perfectly perfect. It was a perfect time to do this film. I think it came out in 98 or so. I think I saw it in 98 or so. 98 or so. And it was the timing was exquisite because we saw these reality shows emerge on American television, and it pre-staged them. It predicted them with a certain accuracy. Of course, it was on a scale that you'll never see on these reality shows, even the bigger ones.
Uh-huh.
I mean, this film has a scale.
Pretty fantastical.
Yeah, but Even on that scale, there's a certain reality that's there. But I don't know. That film has a certain emotional reaction with me. And for years, I could never really understood it. But I saw it again recently. It's a very powerful film for me. I can only say that. I find it, maybe it's because I find the idea of a corporation owning a kid and raising a kid in a context like that so profoundly disturbing and horrible that it just bothers me.
Now we mentioned,
but anyway.
Well, we mentioned 3 Days of the Condor. Would we also put the Parallax View?
Yeah, I was just going to mention that. The Parallax View is an interesting film primarily because of the end. It's with Warren Beatty, came out in 1974, and it's directed by Alan Pakula, who died tragically in a car accident. And I've seen this film a few times. And it's a... It's not a bad film. It's on the fence. I give it 2.5 stars. But the beginning and ending of this film are terrific. Absolutely terrific.
Well, I've read some things about it that essentially it was, you know, a better book that they turned into more of an action movie with ridiculous chases and things like that.
Yeah, that's why it's a 2.5 star film for me. It's definitely worth looking, but I don't think it's a great film. But the beginning and ending of this film, especially the ending to me, is terrific. Some other interesting films for me, V for Vendetta is a very interesting one, especially in light of the sort of post-9/11 world that's emerged. That's a very interesting film. It's based on the comic by Alan Moore. Alan Moore did a comic called, or should I say a
graphic novel.
Graphic novel. I don't want the comic guys trying to kill me. But a graphic novel called From Hell that was done years before by the Hughes brothers, which deals with Jack the Ripper. Now, of course, what's interesting is the conspiratorial context in that film. Because you basically have the killer or killers, I think, emanating from, or possibly coming from, if I recall correctly, from the Freemasons. You had that Freemasonic aspect in From Hell. Interestingly enough, there was another film that dealt with that. It also dealt with kind of the Jack the Ripper aspect, but had Sherlock Holmes and Watson investigating I think, the Jack the Ripper feeling. It was called Murder by Decree. And it was directed by Bob Clark, who, oddly enough, did a film that a lot of horny guys remember called Porky's. And, of course, in this film was James Mason, well-known British actor at the time, and Christopher Plummer, who, of course, as I mentioned, is in the lead role in The Imaginarium Dr. Parnassus. So that's another interesting one. Of course, the Freemasonry aspect is also inherent in that film. There are a number of others I can't get into detail here. One interesting film that was brought up is The Package. It's done by Andrew Davis, who did The Fugitive. And he's done another film. That's an interesting film.
No, that doesn't ring a bell. Okay.
Gene Hackman and Tommy Lee Jones. I think Gene Hackman is a sergeant, a military guy, and he's transporting, he's got to be the minder of this this other soldier, which it turns out is, I believe, the technician. He's involved in a conspiracy. So that's an interesting film, which doesn't get a lot of talk. You know, it was pretty much a forgotten film. That's another one for people to look out for. Arlington Road is an interesting one. I saw this. It's not quite a good movie. It's a fascinating movie. It's not quite a good movie. It deals with Jeff Bridges and Tim Robbins, and basically Tim Robbins is sort of like a militia type, and Jeff Bridges is a professor, and his wife died as an FBI agent, and she died in a raid. The ending of that film, again, kind of like Parallax View, is terrific. The ending of Arlington Road is terrific. I don't want to give away too much in that film, but that's another one, of course, where you have a plot to destroy certain landmarks in that film or certain centers in this film. There's some others that are quite good, like The Constant Gardener is a very good thriller, dealing with companies that are exporting chemicals and so forth to
Test
the third world.
Third world
pesticides and so forth. That's a very well done film. One of my favorite Francis Ford Coppola films called film called The Conversation.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's a great film. One of his best work. Of course, that's about a sound guy. It's about a sound technician. A first rate movie. Fahrenheit 9/11 has been called a conspiracy film by some, and they're absolutely correct. It is. Because what Michael Moore is inferring is a collusion between the Bush administration and Saudi Arabia. He's really trying to sniff around the edges of the whole Saudi Arabian question, which I suspect was part of the reason why a lot of these right-wingers hated Fahrenheit 9/11. Because some of them may have felt he was onto something.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I'm not holding my breath too tightly that he may make a part two, which I think he's made references to.
Oh, really? Yeah. Yeah, that would be interesting. So those are just a few. Like I said, I can't go into
Actually, can I interject one thing, and then we'll continue? That several of the movies that we have mentioned all seem to come from the 1970s. And, you know, the 70s, not only a golden age of film, but also seems to be a kind of ground zero for what people call conspiracy films.
Yes, very interesting point. A number of them are from the 70s. Some of them are from the 80s, some of them from the 90s and right now. But the 70s, very important. As I mentioned, 3 Days of the Condor, that's a 70s film. So some of them are from that period. And I think part of that is because you had basically the revelations, not only in the 70s, but also getting into the 80s, the revelations of misconduct and abuse by intelligence agencies like the CIA. You had Watergate. That was a huge factor. Basically, Watergate opened the door to the idea of the government as a malevolent entity. Not that that wasn't something that could potentially happen, but if you look at basically also the sea change in films, you got to keep in mind that there was a production code prior to the 60s in U.S. films, and that production code forbade things such as nudity, obviously explicit sex, even interracial relationships were verboten in regards to the production code.
Is that the Hayes?
And what
Hayes
the production code was over. Go ahead.
Was that the Hayes production code?
Well, Well, you got the production code and you have the Hayes Act. Hayes came in, he was a former postmaster general, and what he did was he kind of created guidelines. And he was serving as a sort of, you know, involved in that kind of moral oversight, quote-unquote morals, I use that with quotes, over aspects of the film industry. But the production code, you talk about guys like Joseph Breen, and he was like the head of the production office, production code office. And that was a more specific code that came out in the 30s, I believe in 1934, and that had very specific guidelines and rules to it. Like, because you have to understand, years ago, there were censor offices in various cities and states in the country. And these offices could censor films. And they did. Virginia had one, I believe New York had one. There are a few states, not all states had one, but a number of states. And they would charge you to the studios, right? If they cut this scene they found objectionable or that scene they found objectionable, they charge, you know, stuff to the studios. So production code was a part of a uniform set of guidelines that would enable the studios to say what worked or what didn't work or what was deemed acceptable or unacceptable. So you had the production code. And I never really got into this, but the production code kind of provided a context within material, too. I mean, it's not that you couldn't do conspiratorial stuff, but the idea that the government is a malevolent entity that wants to hurt people and not help them, the idea that they're engaged in illegal, subversive activities that are detrimental to the well-being of hardworking, tax-paying citizens, it's something that probably would not be considered, you know, acceptable under the production code. Although I don't know if anyone's written about this or gone into detail about it. So I think that's part of the sea change that happened in regards to conspiracy. I think that's what happened. I think when we take a look at conspiracies in film and TV, I think the main thrust is in the post-war era, and primarily when we take a look at what I call the conspiracy infrastructure that I am called here, film and TV, I think you have to take a look first in the 90s. I mean, I've cited a number of films, including those in the 70s. And let me, before I get into the 90s and beyond, let me just cite one film, because this is the 40th anniversary of the moon landing. There was a film that came out in 1978, called Capricorn One. It was directed by Peter Himes, who's was a cinematographer and he turned director. And Capricorn One is pretty much oriented toward the idea. The story is basically about these NASA astronauts who are played by James Brolin, Sam Waterston, and Shock of Shocks, O.J. Simpson.
O.J. Simpson, that's right.
Yes. Who are supposed to go on a manned mission to Mars. They're supposed to be, like, I guess, the first astronauts on Mars. What happens is they decide, NASA calls off the mission secretly. They say, no, we don't have the technical capability to do it. We've got problems here. What we're going to do is we're going to fake it. So we're going to put you in a studio with red rocks and moon rocks, red Mars rocks and so forth, and we're going to film it and we're going to call it, the Mars mission. And what happens after that? And they're told, you have to shut up, you know. And of course, the whole thriller aspect is what happens after this. You know, their lives probably going to be in danger. What happens if you have a reporter called Robert Caulfield? He's played by Elliot Gould. And he starts sniffing into this. He thinks something's going on here. You know, something's wrong. He starts looking into this. It's an interesting cast. I mentioned Brolin and Waterston and O.J. Simpson. Hal Holbrook, who interestingly enough played Deep Throat in the movie All the President's Men, also cited as a conspiracy film by some, which is to a certain extent, although it's more of an examination of the Watergate conspiracy. Telly Savalas, best known to people and Kojak, who loves you, baby, you know. Karen Black, who is a fairly well-known actress in the period. She'd been in films like Five Easy Pieces. And, of course, Elliot Gould, you know. So a very interesting cast. And, of course, this was pretty much based on, I would have to say, it was pretty much based on, I don't know if it's based on Kasing's book. There was a guy called Kasing who built it, who wrote a book in the 70s called We Didn't Go to the Moon. And he was the guy who pretty much started the whole idea that the moon landing was a conspiracy, that it didn't exist, that NASA didn't have the capability. He was, I think, a former engineer or something like that. And that NASA didn't have the capability to get to the moon, so they faked it. They sent the astronauts off to a studio, filmed them there, you know, plied them with showgirls. I think it was done in Vegas somewhere, some secret facility in Las Vegas. Plied them with showgirls and booze and just had, just set up this fake moon landing. So I think Capricorn 1 is a variant on that, except it takes place, you know, it's for Mars and not the moon. So, so that's a film I wanted to highlight.
Absolutely, yeah, and I have seen that.
Yes, and a late 70s film. Now, let's get to the 90s. The breakthrough film in regards to what I call the conspiratorial infrastructure is Oliver Stone's JFK. And the reason why it's a breakthrough is, one, it was a film that was successful. The film made over $100 million, a fairly big budget film, but it was made over $100 million. It came out in 1991.
Mm-hmm.
The reason why JFK is such a breakthrough in regards to what I call conspiracy films, or films dealing with conspiracy, conspiratorial framework, or infrastructure, is because it was a big-budget film produced by a major studio, Warner Brothers. Warner Brothers also distributed Capricorn 1, interestingly. And another film, which another film I'll be getting into. But you had JFK. JFK is done by Oliver Stone, no stranger to controversy. And it's a film that deals with perhaps the granddaddy of all conspiracies, the assassination of John F. Kennedy. And so, of course, JFK, the screenplay, of course, were based on The Trail of Assassins, which is written by Jim Garrison. And that's the focus of the film. What Stone did so well with JFK is he focused it on a, for the most part, true life event, which was the investigation, the trial initiated by New Orleans District Attorney Jim Garrison in trying to prosecute Clay Shaw, who we later found out was actually involved with the CIA,
and it
which
uses,
is part of what Garrison was trying to prove.
And it uses real names, dates, places, and
right.
events.
It's also a well-made film.
Absolutely.
It's a brilliantly done movie, brilliantly photographed by Robert... brilliantly photographed, well edited. It's a first-rate film, and what it does is it, bit by bit, brick by brick, covers over or eviscerates the official story of the Kennedy assassination. Now, again, I'm speaking about this from an objective basis. I'm not saying that people should believe one or the other in regards to JFK or any other conspiracies. But what it does so brilliantly is it just cuts through the official story. And basically, it's a speculative film. It speculates. It doesn't provide answers. And I think that's one of the reasons why this film was so viciously attacked when it came out. It does not provide answers. It does not say Lyndon Johnson was behind the assassination. Although people said, oh yeah, if you look at those scenes, black and white scenes, Lyndon Johnson's planning the whole assassination. No, that's not what it's inferring. It's not saying the military-industrial complex is behind the assassination. It speculates as to what roles these individuals might have played, if any, in them. And that's what I think the critics of the film didn't understand. They didn't understand this is a speculative energy exercise, and that Stone is saying, look, do what Garrison did. Do the research. Look into it. That's essentially what Stone's doing in the movie. Nobody wanted to face that. He was attacked by Dan Rather. He was attacked by Walter Cronkite. His film got attacked before it came out. A script was stolen.
Which we've never really seen happen before or since, to my knowledge.
Oh, yeah.
To that degree.
They were after this film from day one. It was very clear. The the major media outlets like Newsweek, which did a front page story on it, Time, and others, went after this film with interventions. And the film, despite that, the film became instant, because of that, I would say, the film became a success. I mean, it was, here you have a very overtly political film, which is box office poison. They made a lot of money, made enough money to be a hit. So JFK was a breakthrough film because it demonstrated that, one, there was an audience for conspiracy lore that was not this fringe, necessarily, audience. And this is a major film with major actors. You got to understand, Kevin Costner, who was at the height of his star power, was in this film. You had various other people like Ed Asner, Walter Matthau, Kevin Bacon, John Candy, who was a comedian. I think this is like one of his first serious roles.
And just, probably one of his last, I think, unfortunately.
I think, well, not his last, but one of his last.
One of them, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, JFK is easily one of my favorite films. It's just, like you're saying, it has the whole package, just top to bottom, right. Production, execution, all of it.
And I think that probably bothered a lot of people, because this was a well, for the most part, well-written, well-directed, well-made film. And I think that bothered the critics of this movie, and it bothered a lot of people that it was so successful. And it demonstrated that the so-called conspiratorial framework could be rendered in an intelligent, logical, rational fashion. That it didn't have to be raving lunatics with, I don't know, tinfoil hats screaming about the JFK assassination. That they could be reasoned, rational discourse and examination. And that always bothers people. When you deal with material like this and you deal with it in a rational fashion, it's disturbing to them. It's bothersome. But, you know, that was, I think, a breakthrough. So from JFK, what we see is the beginning of what I would call, again, a conspiratorial infrastructure. The other breakthrough in regards to television primarily is a show called The X-Files. And the reason why The X-Files was such a breakthrough is because that's a film that didn't deal with a conspiracy, per se. You didn't have the Kennedy assassination exposed. You didn't have a specific historical event. It dealt with what I would call a body of conspiracies, basically primarily dealing with the alien UFO aspect. Now, I have to be careful with this, because this is another area of big contention. But people are willing to discuss JFK, but when it comes to UFOs, they get pretty antsy. And I have to say up front, and I don't know how many people will attack me for saying this, I do not believe that there is life on other planets. I'll make that very clear in this discussion and in this interview. I do not believe there's life on other planets. Intelligent, sentient beings, greys, what have you, I do not believe that they exist. I do not believe there's intelligent life on other planets. I have not seen any evidence that would suggest to me. Is there plant life? Is there biological life? I mean, is there bacteriological life? Yes, probably. But not intelligent life in the sense of beings not quite like us, but almost like us in some form. No, I'm sorry. I don't buy it. That having been said, The X-Files, again, is a breakthrough because it's a show that deals, of course, with what I call the underside of the iceberg, as I mentioned before. And, of course, the structure of the show, you know, the continuum is you have Fox Mulder, who is the FBI agent, who has that big sign in his office which says, "I want to believe." And he does believe because of the personal trauma he's gone through, the fact that his sister was taken from him. He believes by aliens. So that trauma has affected him deeply. It's a personal trauma. And that's very important when you look at a show like The X-Files. Because the personal aspect is very important on that show. What happens to these people personally? It's not just a matter of conjecture for him. He lost a family member to something. Alien, UFO, he doesn't know. But she's gone. Or was gone to a certain extent. Dana Scully, who's a medical doctor primarily, she's the disbeliever, right? She's the skeptic, she's... Mulder, you're crazy. You don't know what you're talking about. But in the run of the show, Scully begins to believe. That's the interesting thing about the exo. She gets to a point where she knows there's something going on here. There's something not quite right. So a lot of the show, of course, deals with the extraterrestrial, the UFO. What the X-Files was able to do, the X-Files was able to tap into these aspects, some of which I had read about for years before. I'd read about UFOs. I didn't really particularly believe in them, but I had read about them. So when the X-Files came along, I saw a show that had a platform that was where they treated these subjects, whether it's government conspiracies, which was a big factor in the X-Files, to cover up aliens and other kinds of, let's say, non-human or extraordinary human, extra-human phenomena. There's the alien factor, the UFO factor, the blood factor. And there's also the sort of offbeat humorous factor. It's a show with humor, too. What made X-Files different, I think what made the show succeed, was the fact that it was rendered intelligently. Again, like JFK, rational, for the most part logical, for the most part reasonable. The show treats its subject matter with respect. It doesn't dismiss it out of hand. It says, aliens, UFOs, they might exist, might be possible, let's examine it. Let's find out what happened. And that's what made the X-Files so very different. It took this material that would normally have been dismissed by other shows as kind of stock episodes, as kind of thriller of the week material, as kind of a plot point that just furthers the script, the story of an episode. And it dealt with them from week to week, and it treated it with, if not respect, then at least the ability to listen. It's like a conversation. To have a conversation, you can't just talk. You have to listen. And that's what the X-Files contributed, and I think why it was such a breakthrough. It provided the opportunity to listen, not just to talk.
I think something maybe to note about the 90s as well, and this just kind of came to me, is that this was perhaps an era where, you know, a different technology kind of came around where people were able to kind of cheaply produce documentaries. And I'm thinking of then things when, like, the Clinton conspiracy was, right, you know, and that was something that was almost kind of grassroots and pre-internet. But again, it's a conspiracy film, for better or worse.
Right. That's interesting. I think that was also a part of the political aspect. You had Hillary Clinton saying at one point, there is a vast right-wing conspiracy to get her husband. And she wasn't entirely wrong. There was a vast right-wing conspiracy. Now, it may not have been that vast, but there was a right-wing conspiracy. I mean, she wasn't lying. She was right. But you can see that there was an undertone that was conspiratorial in those years. The belief that we are forces that are out to get us. You know, that they're consolidated against them. And again, the X-Files fed into this, people would say paranoia, I would say just this apprehension, this anxiety, this unconscious and both conscious belief that something is going on and we need to find out what's going on. As they said on the X-Files, the truth is out there. It's a very nice phrase because it suggests what? Investigation. Much like JFK, JFK is speculative and saying, in essence, it's telling you, look this up for yourself, go out and find it out for yourself. X-Files also kind of has that feeling, although it's not telling people, go out, look this up, but it is kind of saying, there's something out there. The truth is out there. Where can we find it? That's the difference. We have to look to find it. That's very important. Now, specifically when we deal with conspiracies, the conspiracies that have probably popped up on this site and numerous other sites and on talk shows and so forth, the most specific aspect when we talk about conspiracy in movies is a movie called Conspiracy Theory. Now, that movie came out more than 10 years ago, in 1997. Now, Conspiracy Theory is an interesting film for me because I remember when this film came out, I saw it, and this is when I was first getting into my examination, my personal examination of conspiracies. And I had heard about a lot, when I saw the movie, a lot of the stuff was familiar because I had heard people talk to me about this, I heard people tell me about this, and you know, I didn't know whether they were crazy or sane or whatever, but now, what conspiracy theory, the problem with conspiracy theory, and for those who haven't seen the movie, it stars Mel Gibson, no stranger to controversy, and Julia Roberts, major cast, major stars there. It was directed by Richard Donner, who has done numerous films, the Lethal Weapon films, which he had done with Mel Gibson.
And Goonies.
Interesting. Right?
And Goonies.
Yes, the Goonies, yes. Which is a movie I liked when I was younger.
It doesn't hold up very well. Don't go back to it.
Yeah. But when I was younger, I liked it. It was a nice kid film. Nice, fairly big scale kid film in some respects. But it was a nice kid film, you know? It was a good film. I haven't seen it in years, but yeah, it was enjoyable. Now, conspiracy theory revolves around a guy called Jerry Fletcher, and he's a taxi driver, and you know, he's like a guy who's had too many cups of coffee. He's always kind of antsy and, you know, fidgety and has a kind of off-putting quality about him. And basically, Julia Roberts is playing a federal prosecutor. She's with the Department of Justice in this film. And he's basically, Jerry puts out this, I think it's a newsletter called Conspiracy Theory, which is interesting because it was 97 when the web was slowly becoming more and more a part of American life, though not entrenched yet. So it's interesting that he wasn't online. I think if this film had been remade, it would have been online. The problem with conspiracy theory, and of course, Jerry, you know, gets into problems because they have a character played by Patrick Stewart. Those of you who are Star Trek fans know Patrick Stewart, Captain Jean-Luc Picard on Star Trek Next Generation. And he's playing basically a guy with the CIA. And it turns out that Jerry was a member of a organization. I mean, he was a member of a group within the CIA that were involved with, sort of like MK Ultra type activity, sort of brainwashing and coercion and that sort of thing. So he was a part of this group. And another plot line is the fact that Julia Roberts' father was killed. He was a judge. And she's kind of been looking and trying to get that case, you know, looked at, trying to find out who killed her dad. And Jerry may have the key to that. So basically the intrigue is you have James, you know, Patrick Stewart plays Jonas, and his goons after Jerry, and Jerry's on the run. Now, this was a major production. I mean, this is a film that cost at least $80 million to make. This was a major production. It ended up grossing over $100 million. I think it basically broke even. But worldwide. But a conspiracy theory is a relevant film because, one, the title. Two, the character in the film. I think conspiracy theory is kind of a perfect example of what Hollywood really thinks of conspiracy. That's my belief. So I think it's a very exploitive film. And well, have you seen conspiracy theory?
I have seen it. And doesn't he get waterboarded at some point in the film?
Oh, yeah. I think he gets basically, he's in a wheelchair, and I think he's sort of like forced to go underwater. They force him under.
Mm-hmm.
It's not waterboarding in the sense that we've seen it, but it's a more direct form of waterboarding where they just push him on and make sure he gets pushed underwater.
It's been a while since I've seen that film.
Yeah, I saw it maybe a few months ago, and it's my belief at the time was the film should have been done as a small-scale film. It should have been basically an indie film. Instead, it became a big-budget affair because you had Mel Gibson and Julia Roberts involved, and it might have worked as a smaller-scale film, as a smaller-budgeted film. But when you take a look at conspiracy theory, again, this is when we talk about conspiracies and secret societies and how they're used in films, they're used by Hollywood filmmakers and producers primarily as plot material, as story material, as a way to further characters. I mean, what's more perfect in regards to a man in jeopardy, a woman in jeopardy, and to place them in relation to a major conspiracy? My belief is that the Hollywood use of conspiracy is exploitative, like it is for most other things. I mean, let's face it. Someone made the argument that Hollywood is, that, you know, that Hollywood film, all Hollywood films are exploitation films because they all exploit some aspect. Could be sexuality, it could be politics, it could be race, gender, whatever, violence especially, but all films, Hollywood films, are you know, exploitation films. And that's an interesting take. In the case of conspiracy theory, again, we have the exploitation of conspiracy, and this is sort of a pluperfect example of conspiracy used to further the means of product or entertainment, because the character in the conspiracy theory is considered a reject. He's a taxi driver. He's considered unstable, crazy, loony, you know, out of his gourd. You can't take him seriously.
And it's they make him a taxi driver, making allusions to unstable taxi drivers like Travis Bickle.
Right, in the movie Taxi Driver, you know, Travis Bickle, that's Martin Scorsese's great film, Taxi Driver, from 1976. And, of course, that character is somebody who wants to assassinate a major political figure, presidential candidate or what have you. And that's the whole thrust of this film, is this sort of alienated figure, this kind of figure that is bifurcated from American society. He's not a part of the mainstream. He's someone who, well, in that film, Taxi Driver, Travis Bickle becomes, I think, kind of a folk hero because of his killing of a few other people. But that's important. I mean, when we take a look at the conspiracy theory, basically, to me, is Hollywood's take on conspiracy, their major take, and their belief that this is nonsense, this is phony, this is foolish. The idea of believing, the idea that of taking conspiracy, any kind of conspiracy, seriously, is a joke, because the Jerry character is a joke. Or, you know, even though he's right about certain things near the end, he's still considered a joke. So that's a way of marginalizing. And again, I'm not somebody who's saying that conspiracies in and of themselves should be believed or disbelieved or what have you. I'm saying I look at them from a more objective standpoint, and to me it's a matter of what can we see about, are these, again, these provable, or can these be proven or disproven? In the case of conspiracy theory, again, I think it's a very basic trope. These guys don't know what they're talking about. Now, of course, this film was done before 9/11. That's very important. But it fits into that, I believe, the basic mainstream view of Hollywood, which is the belief that conspiracies generally, again, the idea that conspiracy theories are foolish and are dumb, or that there's no weight to it.
And that if there is something sinister going on, it's something that's kind of your own fault or of your own making, and it's a small thing. It's not large and nefarious.
Right, precisely. It's, you know, it's something that you shouldn't worry about. You know, it's, you know, the trust factor is very important, because you have to understand, after Watergate, there was a great deal of mistrust. Really, after Vietnam, there was a great deal of distrust already. The currents of the 60s are very important, right? You had the Vietnam War, you have the Civil Rights Movement, you have what eventually became the Women's Movement. You had a lot of the movements that are rising out of that, and they're born on a need to reform or to remake American society or aspects thereof. And so, therefore, that's predicated on a certain amount of distrust. We don't trust the status quo. We don't trust the establishment. We don't trust the mainstream. And, of course, that's where conspiracies come in. You know, conspiracies are a matter of looking at alternative explanation, which is really what conspiracies are. A lot of people who are against conspiracies make a big deal out of them, and they view it as being silly or nonsensical. Really, what they are alternative explanations, right? If you don't believe, for example, that Sirhan Sirhan was the only shooter in the Ambassador Hotel in the late 60s who shot at Robert F. Kennedy, you have to have an alternative explanation. You can't. If that doesn't fit, then you have to find something else that will explain. So what conspiracies do is they provide alternative explanations. It's up to the official sources, the official bodies, to determine whether those, whether it's alternatives that other people have conjured up or ones that they've possibly conjured up or considered, whether they are true or untrue or whether they can be proven or disproven.
So
that's what you've got to keep in mind. That's what people have to keep in mind.
We've mentioned now Robert De Niro a couple of times, so perhaps it's time to mention his most recent film that he directed, which I believe was only the second film that Robert De Niro directed, the first being Bronx Tale.
Correct.
Let's talk
about
his second
film. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, let's talk about The Good Shepherd.
Absolutely. The Good Shepherd came out not too long ago. I just saw it. In fact, I have to take it back to a library because it's due. But The Good Shepherd, of course, is actually about the CIA. And it's about kind of the early years of the CIA through a character played by Matt Damon. And Matt Damon's good in this film. Now, what's significant when we talk about this other aspect, which I haven't gone into too much discussion about, which is secret society, is that The Good Shepherd features Skull and Bones. Now, why do they feature Skull and Bones? Because Matt Damon's character is a member of Skull and Bones. So we see them basically in the tombs. For those people who aren't familiar with Skull and Bones is a secret society at Yale. I believe it was founded, I'm trying to think back, I was looking into Skull and Bones not too long ago. I believe in the 19th century, by I believe one of the Tafts. There are a number of secret societies and societies, college societies. Now, I know you went to Shepherd College, right? In West
Virginia. I did.
Yeah, I don't believe there were too many secret societies there, I guess.
No, just good shepherds. Sorry.
Is that like a fraternity or something?
No, I was just making a bad joke.
Okay. Sorry, I get it. That was funny. I guess that would be an alumnus, right? Outstanding alumnus at Shepherd College. But now, I was just doing this kind of a research online, and what you have are different, colleges have different societies. Yale has several. Skull and Bones isn't the only secret society at Yale. Actually, interestingly enough, Phi Beta Kappa was a secret society, and that's known as kind of the honors fraternity. Right? If you graduate with honors at a college, sometimes you're Phi Beta Kappa. That was a secret society. And in the 1830s or thereabouts, they decided to kind of renounce the secrecy aspect and just make it a regular frat, or make it fraternal order. So you have the college secret society, and Yale's Skull and Bones, of course, is a secret society. To enter, of course, you have to be tapped. And what happens in the film, that Matt Damon is tapped, basically. I don't think he's literally tapped, but they touched him on the shoulder, and he was playing a woman in Gilbert and Sullivan operetta or something like that?
I think so.
Yeah, I don't know if it's HMS Pinafore, but... Now, what's interesting, of course, is that Matt Damon is actually not a Yale man. He's a Harvard man. He went to Harvard. I don't think he got to graduate, but he's a Harvard, basically a Harvard man, though not a graduate. So it's interesting that a Harvard man was doing sort of playing a Yale man at Skull and Bones. But different colleges, a different society. You have St. Anthony Hall, I believe, at Columbia. Of course, Phi Beta Kappa was at William & Mary. But in The Good Shepherd, of course, he's in the rituals initiations. That includes wrestling. And, of course, probably the biggest factor in the initiation is getting into the coffin and disclosing your most intimate secrets. And you see that in The Good Shepherd. So that, of course, deals with Skull and Bones. Now, The Good Shepherd doesn't go into exhausting detail about Skull and Bones because that's just an aspect. What it does is it's setting up the Boys Club, the old boys network, which is what Skull and Bones basically is. It's an old boys network. And that's why you have people like George W. Bush and John Kerry, who are Bonesmen. And they were asked on Meet the Press in when they were interviewed by, not together, but in separate interviews by Tim Russert. Tim Russert came right out and said, tell me about 322, tell me about Skull and Bones. Bush said, well, you know, I can't talk about that. They both said, Kerry just wanted to go on to another topic. But there is no secret that we need reform in health care. But they're both Bonesmen. They're both Yaleys. So that aspect is seen in the movie The Good Shepherd. And, of course, it's there to set up the Old Boys Network, right? The secretive nature. It makes sense that he would be a member of a secret society and be part of a secret organization like the CIA, which is the secret organization in and of itself, even though it has oversight by the Congress. You know, I mean, it's an intelligence operation. Anytime you have an intelligence agency, there's always secrecy involved. It has to be. So that's an interesting film in regards to that component. There was also another film that came out in 2000 called The Skulls.
I wondered if you were going to bring that up.
Right. That was loosely based on Skull and Bones. The difference is, with those films, of course, that's explicitly about it, and it's more of a generic entertainment film. The Good Shepherd is more of a history of the CIA, and it features Skull and Bones as part of the lead-up for the Matt Damon character to get involved in intelligence work. Skulls is explicitly about Skull and Bones, though not specifically about Skull and Bones.
But it's about joining a secret society at college.
Right, basically the Skulls. And so I think some of the... I don't think they go into all of the so-called secrets of the society in there, at least the secrets as I have read about them. And it's more of a generic entertainment film because you have a character who is played by Joshua Jackson and he becomes a member of Skull and Bones. And then I think his roommate gets killed by one of the Bonesmen there because he went into the... I don't know what they call it in the film, the crypt, the tomb, something along that line. The real Skull and Bones is the tomb, I believe. It's the tombs. So, basically, that film is a more generic entertainment kind of thriller. Again, that film is kind of based on Skull and Bones, but it's not explicitly about Skull and Bones. In other words, if you're looking at that film to find out the exact absolutes about Skull and Bones, forget it. They take the seeds of that, some of the aspects, and they turn it into this kind of generic studio entertainment. So that specifically, you have those films dealing with Skull and Bones, which is a real society and a real old boys network.
Some of the parts with The Good Shepherd that I find interesting is that it does kind of conflate and kind of confuse some of the historical issues. And again, I don't think they really use any proper names. The Matt Damon character, I don't think is called James Jesus Angleton, which is pretty much, I believe, who he was based on.
That's what I was thinking.
The names are changed, right?
Right. Yeah, because that's not... Well, let's face it. He does look a little like Mother. Because the... what's his name? The Alec Baldwin character was an FBI agent. Basically, his FBI... I don't want to say counterpart, but the guy who is his contact at the FBI basically says, yeah, the boys of the FBI call you Mother. That's Mother, of course, was the name of James Jesus Angleton.
Well, the specific thing that I wanted to mention was that the Russian defector that they show them dosing with, you know, their then experimental LSD, and he jumps out the window. That's a conflation of the story, of the real story of Frank Olson, a CIA agent who was fed LSD and jumped out the window in New York, I believe.
Right. Yeah, conflation, I like that term, conflation. You know, the tales have been changed to protect the innocent and to protect us from lawsuits. But, yeah, James Olson was on LSD. This is when the CIA was testing LSD. And as I'm sure some of the listeners of this interview will be aware, they were using LSD on unaware test subjects in whorehouses, I think. They were hiring prostitutes to basically dose them. Nasty business. But it's the CIA, and they're nasty. Let's be honest. That's their business. Their business is nasty. I mean, you know, I'm sure the spooks, if they're listening to any of this now, would probably agree.
Yeah, they couldn't really argue
if they're listening to this, it would probably be NSA listening to this, not necessarily the CIA.
They'll pass it on.
Yeah, I'm sure they will. I don't know the relationship. I haven't gotten into the relationship between NSA and CIA as much in terms of my reading, but one of these days I'll get to it. But
well, and so what do you think are some of the other films we want to try and go over quickly as we start to wind it down here?
Yeah, the final one that I wanted to mention is an interesting film called National Treasure, which came out a few years ago. It came out in 2004. And this comes from Walt Disney Studios. Now, interestingly enough, I had mentioned X-Files and that show. X-Files was created by a guy called Chris Carter. Chris Carter was a former freelance writer. He had written for Surfing Magazine before he got a chance. I think Jeffrey Katzenberg gave him a shot in, what is it, 85 or so, in the 80s. He said, gave him a shot to give him a contract with Disney. So he was, interestingly enough, producing like shows for Disney and films, writing TV movies for Disney. And National Treasure, of course, comes from Walt Disney Pictures, not Touchstone or all the other divisions. Walt Disney Pictures. Now, interestingly enough, in this film we have, it stars Nicolas Cage. Also in this film is John Voight. Now, John Voight, we know him from numerous movies. He was also in a movie called Enemy of the State, which is also cited as a conspiracy film, right? Because he's a senator, I believe, in that film. You know, who's, threatened by the, Will Smith character. Uh-huh. And he's also in a movie called Deadwood, I believe. Is it Rosewood? Okay. I believe. That's directed by, I think, the director John Singleton. And, of course, in that film you have Masonic imagery. I think one of the characters is a Mason. So we have John Voight in this film. Christopher Plummer's in this film, interestingly enough. Harvey Keitel and a few other actors. And this film basically deals with, you have Nicolas Cage, he's a fairly well-educated guy, he's got a degree from MIT in mechanical engineering, he's got a degree from American history from Georgetown, so he's a real kind of history buff, and it kind of goes through his family, because his family had been kind of looking for this trove of treasure, I believe, because that's where the Christopher Plummer character comes in. He's the grandfather, and you have a flashback to him. And the thing about National Treasure is, of course, it's kind of not so much a treasure hunt, but it's basically an agglomeration of clues. So the whole film is about finding out, decoding, deciphering, and basically being able to, interpret all of these clues so they'll be able to get to the treasure, get to the important documents. So the villain in that is Sean Bean, who he's been in other movies, Flight Plan with Jodie Foster, and of course he was in GoldenEye, James Bond film with Pierce Brosnan. So basically you get into all of these clues. For example, the quote by the last signer of the Declaration of Independence, the secret lies with Charlotte. So that's the first clue. And what they probably mean is a ship called the Charlotte. And then there's a separate riddle that's there. So they're going, they go on this mad dash throughout various, a few cities.
It's kind of, scavenger hunt style.
Yeah, it's kind of a treasure hunt, scavenger hunt. But the film is called National Treasure. So, they go through all of these clues, so you can get this treasure. And in this mix, we have a combination of factors, right? You have Freemasonry, because the FBI agent played by Harvey Keitel is a Freemason. And basically, he's kind of saying, yeah, don't worry, you know, secret's safe with us. You also have, I believe, the Templars, because I think this is like a Templar treasure. And, of course, that's very important. You know, the all-seeing eye is involved. So we can see, you know, certain aspects of secret society lore, not so much conspiratorial lore, although they can say that. For example, when I mentioned the all-seeing eye, you know, that's one of the clues, right? And, of course, the all-seeing eye can be seen on, you know, currency, you know, dollar bill. But it's also a number of other clues in this film. I mean, I could go through them, right?
Well, I think it's interesting that you did point out, and I hadn't quite thought of this, that, yeah, in the massive Walt Disney empire, they could have put it out under Touchstone or Hollywood or any of their subsidiaries, but they put it out as a Walt Disney film, marketing it pretty much, you know, implicitly to kids. And, of course, it had a sequel. There's, you know, boxes right. of cereal that had, you know, get the prize out of it. Yep. And I think it acts to maybe normalize these sorts of things. But it
now,
also...
that's interesting. Now, that's interesting. Now, that is sort of the flip side of conspiracy theory. See, in conspiracy theory, what they're basically doing is they're ridiculing the idea of conspiracy or examining various aspects of historical events, you know, looking, as I say, again, beneath the iceberg. Here, the thrill is in the examination, in the investigation. So it's kind of fun to look into the history, to look into various aspects. You know, the clues are, you know, you look at the clues and, you know, the secret lies with Charlotte, which is the ship. You know, you have the cipher on the back of the Declaration of Independence. You've got, you know, looking at the $100 bill, and of course, you've got the Trinity Church symbol in New York City, which is in Wall Street and Broadway, beneath Parkington Lane. You know, if you look at it with the right kind of device, it's referring to Master Mason, which is Freemasonry. And, of course, the all-seeing eye, which is relating to the Freemasonic symbol. So here, I think that's a good point that you bring out. It's kind of, in a sense, educating people to various aspects, but of, I think, secret society lore. But it's doing it in a not so much educational way, but through a entertaining way.
Absolutely.
Right? This thriller.
This is fun
this
movie
case,
stuff.
It's an enjoyable film. There's no doubt about it. I enjoyed it. I mean, you know, there were critics that didn't like it. In fact, I think the critical consensus of it is that it was a silly movie. But I didn't think it was so much silly as it was just a good yarn. And I think it's a yarn that's more worthy of examination than most of these critics are willing to provide it.
Well, and I think... We may have to draw it to a close here. I know you've got movies you got to get back to the store.
That's right. I do. But the last thing I do want to bring out in sort of conclusion is National Treasure is a good way to end because, again, when we deal with conspiracies, we're looking at the two tropes here. We're looking at, I think, there are two schools of thought, whether intentional or unintentional. The first school of thought is that secret societies and conspiracies are not worth examining. That they're made up phony stories, even though these societies exist. As I mentioned, Skull and Bones is real. It's not fake. It exists. You know, the Freemasons are real. Again, they're controversial, and I don't pretend to have all the answers about the Freemasons. I'm not going to bite the bullet that they're just, you know, evil Satanists who want to rule the world. I don't think that's entirely... I don't think that's accurate, or even logical. But you deal with secret societies, and we also deal with the idea of conspiracy. And I think when we take a look in conclusion, I think the reason why, for example, the JFK and X-Files were so important and why they were so groundbreaking was their examination of conspiracy lore in particular. they looked at conspiracy lore, whether it involved earthly conspiracies, such as JFK, the assassination of John F. Kennedy, or unearthly conspiracies, such as aliens or UFOs, what have you, with intelligence, with reason, with insight. And I think that made the difference. They were treated seriously. They were examined seriously. And they called for an audience to examine for themselves. But this was not done in an overt way, saying, you have to go and do this. It was done in a so-called covert way by example. We've done it, now you go ahead and do it. So it's by implication. And I think, as I mentioned, the one school is that these aren't worth it. These aren't worth examining. These conspiracies or secret societies aren't worth examining. The other school is they are worth examining, and they may be, you know, enjoyable. I guess on the one hand you have conspiracy theory, and the other hand is national treasure. And I think in that case it's more subtle. That's why I don't think National Treasure is a silly movie. I mean, it's entertainment, it's meant to be just good fun, but it's not silly because I think at the root of it, it's basically saying that these conspiracies, these secret societies are worth examination, they're worth study, they're worth effort, they're worth looking at, even if it means going out and... Because the character played by Nicolas Cage is considered not crazy, but eccentric to a certain extent, to a mild extent. He's not quite considered within the mainstream, but he's not so far out of the mainstream as to be like the Jerry Fletcher character, a conspiracy theory, which is interesting. And I think that's very important. I think those are two schools of thought when we take a look at the basically the secret is out, secret societies and conspiracies in film and TV. My view is that secret societies and conspiracies are worth examination and study. And that's what I've done. I've examined them, I've studied them. I haven't said that you need to believe in secret societies because that's moronic. I don't believe in Skull and Bones. Skull and Bones exist because the knowledge is there, the research is there. Mm-hmm. Freemasons exist. I know. There's a Masonic Hall in Honolulu. I know where it is. I've gone by numerous times. No, I'm not a Mason. I'm not a member. Please, you know, no threats, no emails, please. But I know where it is. These organizations exist. And my belief is they should be examined. Now, if it was good enough for Bill Clinton's mentor, you know, Carol Quigley, at, you know, Georgetown University to write Tragedy and Hope, then I think it's worthy of anyone else to examine and to look into. And my examination here is primarily in regards to movies because I find that interesting. It's something I've just kind of gotten into, and I find it very interesting.
Absolutely.
I find it really fascinating.
Absolutely. And when we think about it, I mean, these are the things that people are watching. Film is easily, mm-hmm. you know, the dominant art form of 20th and 21st century. People mm-hmm. aren't sitting at home right now maybe reading Tragedy and Hope or reading historical things about conspiracies in history.
Right.
They're watching movies and TV shows that have these elements throughout.
Or they're doing both online.
Hopefully.
They're watching
Hopefully.
A movie and maybe looking up a website or maybe a monarchy. And I think that's very important. And again, this is of a piece, not so much with my other work. I've discussed what I call the crisis of journalism on the show. But this kind of is of a piece with my look reviewing films. And it kind of blends into that because I don't know how many films I've reviewed over the years, but I've seen these films, or a number of these films, and I've kind of looked at it from a reviewer standpoint, but never really from the other standpoint as a writer. I've never brought my other side into it. So this is kind of the first time I've done it, and I've kind of enjoyed it, I have to say. But it's interesting. It's something I might end up speaking about or talking about again, because I kind of enjoyed discussing it here. I mean, it's very, very fascinating.
Absolutely.
Subject.
Well, yeah, let me say right now, yeah, that anytime we want to continue this, and I'm sure that's the thing,
sure.
we could go over so many other things. So as we wrap it up here, I want to throw out two things that we didn't mention and movies that we haven't mentioned off mic, so I'm not sure if you're familiar with either of these.
Mm-hmm.
A film from 1970 that was made for TV and stars Glenn Ford called The Brotherhood of the Bell.
I've heard of it. I'm not that familiar with it, but it has come up in my research.
Okay, and that actually, and we can maybe even link that up. The whole film's available up on Google Video. You can watch the whole thing. I'm sure it's all, you know, public domain by this point. The other movie has yet to come out. It was supposed to, I think, have already come out, but they keep bumping it back. And this is a movie that, when I was going to the theater a couple months ago, saw a trailer for it, and I sort of knew. I was like, this is going to be about CIA and mind control. And that's Martin Scorsese's upcoming movie, Shutter Island.
Shutter Island, yeah. I had the book. That's going to be, I think, a big movie because Scorsese is involved. That's a huge movie in regards to my now burgeoning field of movie research in regards to and my framework now, which is debuted on the show, The Secret is Out, Secret Society Conspiracies in Film and TV. That's going to be, again, another aspect, some might critically say, a tentacle to this octopus. But that's going to be a fascinating movie because Leonardo DiCaprio's in it. Again, Scorsese's behind it. This is a major studio picture with a major director. And again, another important film. So again, we're looking at the currents in regards to this. And of course, we're looking at mind control. Let's not forget also another interesting film, I think it's coming out, The Men Who Saw Goats.
Oh yeah, The Men Who Stare at Goats.
Stare at Goats, right. Based on John Ronson. John Ronson wrote a book called Them, where he had interviews with David Icke and Alex Jones. And various other aspects when we're dealing with the so-called New World Order and so forth. So that's pretty interesting. That's another interesting aspect. So that's a major film. Again, you have George Clooney in it. He's one of the biggest names in Hollywood. If he's in a movie, it's going to be pretty big.
And he does seem to enjoy working on things that do have a little bit of, you know, definitely like political overtones, overt.
Right. Right. He's an unapologetic liberal for the most part. Clooney's an unapologetic liberal, and I have a lot of respect for him. He's pretty much unapologetic. There are people like O'Reilly who can't stand him. And his films, sort of like Good Night and Good Luck, which deals with the McCarthy era, which is really about television. And that's an interesting film to watch about TV.
And it's beautiful.
Which is the important part. It's very well done. Good Night and Good Luck. But yeah, I think that's a very good point about, but not all his films are political. He did Leatherheads, which is about football.
No, that's true.
I don't think it did as well as his other movies.
No.
And of course he did Confessions of a
Dangerous Mind.
Dangerous Mind,
nope.
which is about Chuck Barris, who said he was a CIA asset employee, what have you. Whether he was or not, I think is still debatable. You know, I don't know what research the people have, what you've heard about Chuck Barris or whatever, but I think is still. But that's a very good film as well. So, yeah, Clooney's interesting. But I think Shutter Island's definitely a film to look out for. It should be coming out next year, I believe.
Okay. Well, I think...
That's what I saw. I saw basically a lobby display that said 2010, so I think it's coming up next year. That's what the last I heard. So I think that's definitely a film worth looking out for. And again, if people have any, if they want to talk about the whole conspiracy thing and the whole secret society thing in film or TV, well, they can, I guess, reach me on Facebook. I'm on Facebook.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I'm on Facebook, and I'm also on Twitter. My Twitter site, I'm at Critic Incorporated on Twitter. And actually, that's basically four films. I just do reviews there. I did some coverage of HIF on Twitter. But Facebook, probably the best way to reach me would be to contact me on my email. Probably my email would be ajlanier01@msn.com. That's ajlanier01@msn.com. So if you have any suggestions, any comments about conspiracy films or films with secret societies in them, that's a place to start if you want to reach me.
All right, man. Well, I'll probably be the first one sending you links when this is done going, oh, I meant to mention this or that.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's a fascinating subject. I'm debating as to whether to, you know, write an article about it or write something larger about it. I know there's a book by Garnon B. Arnold called Conspiracy Theory in Film, Television, and Politics, but I haven't read that. So my conceptual framework is very different after you have heard in this interview. It's more about two schools of thought and the two schools, the two tropes, and the use of conspiracy and the use of secret societies, which is both overt and covert.
All right, man. I think that's going to do it. Thanks so much. This has been great.
Thank you so much. Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. And thank you. And thanks for having me on Media Marketing.
All right, man. I'll talk to you soon.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
They're coming out with the movie version of my life based on the novel that shouldn't have been written either. I called them up and asked to meet the director to see who would play me, and he said, "You talked about actors but thought instead that playing yourself might lend some cred." All this time I'm trying to halt the production. Apparently one day long ago I gave them all my permission. If that's the case, let's hammer out some details. Remember how I don't do nude scenes or my own stunts. The speech is a failure on all fronts. Just accept that these things are going to happen. Everything is set in motion. It will happen anyway. And on re-argued after all band to try and drum up popular demand. Ask the director, where do I stay? Just accept that these things are going to happen. Everything is set in motion.
How would you explain it?
Combining music and stylized images.
It's all remote control.
Each one of those images was electronically based.
Say about on my threat.
And that concludes our program for tonight.
This could really catch on.
I can't remember when I've been so moved.